couple of years ago in Fresh Air, we discussed jazz and jazz criticism, but today we're going to discuss a different passion, film. His new book, D.W. Griffith, First Artist of the Movies, has been published by the Oxford University Press. Griffith is generally acknowledged as the first film director to develop a film language through his use of close-ups, fades, cross-cutting, and other ways of using the camera and editing block to tell a story. Williams said he should also be recognized as one of America's great dramatists. By the way, a book by Martin Williams on television is scheduled for release in the fall, and that will also be published by the Oxford University Press. Welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a great pleasure to see you again.
Thanks. It's nice to be here, always.
You are obviously writing a lot about jazz and writing about film. What are some of the parallels between these two art forms and between some of the great jazz musicians, someone like Ellington and someone like Griffith?
I think the best way to put that, it seemed to me that many years ago, it seemed to me that people could not really understand jazz. I mean, critics, let's say, people who wanted to get into it deeply, who didn't understand the nature of what I prefer to call the American arts in general. And I think that Americans in general don't understand this either. For instance, a Russian dancer trained in the ballet tradition comes to this country and tells us that one of the great dancers of the 20th century is Fred Astaire. And all of a sudden, we wake up to the fact that that's so. But where have we been? I mean, what else could Fred Astaire be? But let me point out something else about that, which is what I'm trying to get at here. That Russian dancer, of course he's one of the great dancers himself, no question about that. But his way of dancing goes like this. He goes as a young man and says, in effect, I want to be a dancer. And he is told, okay, learn to do this and learn to do it well enough and you will be an artist. Well, no one told Fred Astaire that. No one said to Fred Astaire, learn this, do it well, and you're an artist. No one told Sarah Vaughan, learn to sing this way and do it well enough and you'll be a great singer. American artists learn a new art for a new country by pulling it out of themselves and by pulling it out of what they see around them that appeals to them that they think they can work with. They create the art itself. And I think we really ought to understand what an enormous accomplishment that is. Ellington did not learn to be a great composer by deciding in some abstract sense what a great composer might be and then try to measure up to that in the European tradition. A new country demands a new culture. And this is what I mean about Griffith. It's fine for us to respect and praise Eugene O'Neill, and indeed we should. But when we talk about people like Griffith and John Ford and Leo McCarey, we're apt to be talking about something called popular art, as if we had some unpopular art around. Well, we do, in fact. Why is Griffith not only a great dramatist, but a great dramatist who discovered the way to move an audience in a new medium? That's what he really did. That's quite an accomplishment, I think, and it's something that we really ought all to know more about. And I think that all American artists, in some sense, like all the great jazz musicians, are improvisers. They have to be, because there's no set way to do any of this. You have to find out how to do it effectively and well and artistically, because there are any rules. We're building the rules. That's what we're doing, right? That's what 20th century American culture is all about, building a new set of rules for a new culture. And the other part of that, which I might as well mention right now, is that contemporary American culture is one of the most influential facts in the whole world today. And that's another thing we don't understand. You know, we don't understand the significance of the fact that musicians all over the world want to play our music, see our films, make films like our films, and dance like Fred Astaire. We just don't understand what that means, but it means something terribly important and significant. Okay.
You're talking about how Griffith created the art form as well as creating some of the language for it. When he got started
all of
in film, it was...
There was barely a technique, an expressive technique, for making a story come across on film that he didn't discover or refine. I doubt if there's any, really.
Maybe we should talk about what some of those techniques are. The close-up, I mean, he didn't invent the close-up, no, but he invented using it in films, didn't
yeah.
he?
Well, he didn't invent it even on film, because one of the famous narrative films that was made before Griffith came along is called The Great Train Robbery, and there's a close-up in it. There were close-ups because, for instance, there were portraits in the tradition of painting and photography, because photography just adopted its positions and standards from painting, naturally enough. So there were close-ups. What Griffith did was to use a close-up dramatically to show us something about what's going on inside someone or between two people. And so it's a absolutely new use to put a close-up to. And, well, that's one of the things he did, you know, a camera in motion, superimpositions of shots, the rhythm of cutting. What he did really was, by a kind of sheer, determined intuition, discover the essential fact that in a film, the director is the one in control. Not the scriptwriter, as in the theater. Not the actors, as in the theatrical performance. But the director working with the film cutter. That's the guy who really makes it work or not work. And the central point of view is not the audience's head out there, but the camera. The director in control of the camera and the cutting. That's where the drama happens. And once he had hit upon that, then the whole medium of film came alive with a new kind of life as drama, and with great new possibilities of expressiveness that it had never had before, you know.
It's interesting that he should be the one to do it, since he was an actor and a writer entering the medium of film, and you kind of expect a director to be able to draw on all those abilities.
Exactly. But there's another fact about that I think is really fascinating biographically. Griffith was raised to be a Southern snob. A Southern American snob. Therefore, whatever he got into had to be artistic. Well, he got into this movie thing because he couldn't find a job anywhere else and couldn't find a career anywhere else, and by God, it had to be artistic, so he just, well, made it artistic, you know? And there's something to that. You know?
He wasn't behind the camera. His photographer, cinematographer was. And you explained that the people behind the camera weren't always so sure that a close-up was a very good idea where Griffith wanted it.
Oh, no. The way he wanted to use it, the bosses and even the cameraman who had photographed close-ups before, they were outraged, you know. And the bosses would say things like, I'm paying for this whole actor. I want to see all of him or all of her, you know. And Griffith said, look at me. What do you see? Are you looking at my feet? That's what I want the camera to see. Well, you know, once they'd seen the result, there couldn't be any going back. There couldn't be any question about it. It had to be that way. And that was the thing, I think, that was so wonderful about the whole event. The audience recognized that they had seen something terribly important when they saw Griffith's films, even the very early ones. People began to go to those pictures and look for them, because they knew they were going to have a real aesthetic experience that they couldn't get anywhere else.
Another thing that you mentioned is that the actors, a scene would start with the actors in movement, and it wasn't like actor still, camera gets turned on, then the movement starts.
Yeah. Well, there are even in some early films, they'd actually walk into the set and take their places and then start, and all that would be shown to the audience.
Really? Films? I've never seen anything like that.
Well, it's in The Great Train Robbery, for instance, some of the scenes. You can see them walking up to their marks before they start the next action. But there's an excuse for them entering the room, but still, it doesn't really need to be there. You could start with them already there. You know, you have to sort of persuade yourself that the audience is going to accept dropping down in a scene before all the people have arrived, you know. Let me see how I can explain that better. Well, Here's another parallel case of a discovery. In The Great Train Robbery, when you are using indoor sets and where the actors are working in scenes that are supposed to be in buildings inside of a train station and so forth, they enter and walk from left to right as if they were on stage. And all the movement and all the blocking is, you know, from one side to another. Once they get outdoors, and there are scenes shot outdoors in the wilds of New Jersey, as it happens, it's supposed to be the West, of course, once they get out there, they can move toward the camera and away from the camera, and they can move, you know, kitty-cornered, as we say, from one corner to another and that kind of thing. You have that kind of movement, and some of it is very, in a mild way, it's pretty effective in that film. But it never occurred to anybody while they were indoors on a set not to treat it like a stage set, you know, and make the most of the movement back and forth from left to right or right to left.
Let's look at some of his specific films. Birth of a Nation, a lot of people who haven't seen the film have heard that it's a racist film. And that's for people who haven't seen the film, the information that's most immediately accessible. Before we talk about the film language that he used in Birth of a Nation, can you give us a synopsis of the story that he tells and how that story was treated at the time, how it's treated now, and what you think of what he was saying? Was it racist?
Well, I don't want to use that word, but it's not a bad description of his attitude in a way, but it just throws the whole case out, as you imply, from the beginning. James Agee said that Griffith was a man trying to understand and making a more sincere effort to understand than many people who criticized him. Well, that's true. He totally failed to understand. It's a film about a small community in the South attached to farmland, a plantation. These people are invaded. Their land is pillaged. Their sons go off to war, and a cousin is fighting on the other side and this kind of thing. And then the second half of the film, which is the part that raises so many more problems than it knows how to deal with, is Reconstruction, the exploitation of the South, the exploitation of the blacks, and all of that. But the story that Griffith presents there, the interpretation of all of that, is the one that I, as a Southern-raised American, grew up with. It's total hogwash, and it is racist. But it is racist only because it insists that black people are children. And this is what Griffith himself finally came down to. They were our children, and we took care of them. Well, you see, that's the kind of paternalism. But I must tell you this, I hear the same note of paternalism in the modern liberal who says black people are culturally deprived and we have to give them grants so that they can take care of themselves. There's a note of that in there, and I think we should think seriously about that. Now, by that I don't mean to, you know, to brush aside serious questions at all. There are serious questions for all of us. But some of the solutions seem to me pretty condescending in the same terms that Griffith was being condescending in this film, some contemporary solutions, you know, with the best of intentions.
What was public reaction at the time?
Oh, it was shocking. I mean, the whole Ku Klux Klan thing was renewed. It came out with a new life. There were riots. People were killed. There's no question about that.
How did the film help to spark a new renaissance of the Klan?
Oh, well, you know, the second half is a melodrama in which the good people and the good black people, the loyal house servants, are all trapped by the Klan and about to be killed and raped and so forth. And the cavalry comes to trapped by the carpetbaggers and the northern exploiters and the bad black people in an alliance of Yankees and, you know, uppity blacks, or how the heck that would have been put. And then the Klan comes and rescues them. So it's really one of those, the cavalry, which, of course, in terms of the social and personal problem, solves nothing. It just it reduces the whole problem to the level of a chase melodrama and a last-minute rescue, like the cavalry arriving and so forth. And there's no question that you know, that's a terrible flaw. But there are two things to say about that. First of all, the way he handled that rescue is one of the most effective pieces of film you'll ever see in your life. And every single last-minute rescue that has ever been executed on film by anybody since has been influenced by it. He did this staggering thing of digging a hole in the ground, having horses ride across with the camera pointed upward at their hooves, and all these things. The camera on a truck moving along with the horses as they go through the landscape. And it's terribly powerful, there's absolutely no point in denying that power. I wish in a way that we could view that thing with a kind of objectivity. We know, for instance, that this hit musical about Eva Perón has nothing to do with the real character of that woman and her life and what she did in that country. And yet we go to it and we enjoy it for what it is. We go and hear and see Shakespeare's Richard III as a powerful play about a diabolical man. And in fact, historically, that was not what Richard was like at all. That's a blackmail. I mean, what do I want to say? That's a blackening of his name that was brought about by the subsequent kings because they wanted, you know, history to think of him as being that kind of an evil person. In fact, he was not, we know. But we don't care about that. I mean, whether that's the historical Richard or not doesn't matter. I wish we could see The Birth of a Nation that way. No, that's not history. No, that's not American black people. No, that's not the way the Southern whites were affected by the Civil War, these poor put-upon innocents, you know, who were exploited by these awful Yankees. That's not true. None of that's true. But it is if we could see it as a drama of a land pillaged and trying to restore order. It's a powerful piece of filmmaking or drama. Okay, you know. It's just that it touches us in the wrong way, and it touches everybody's guilt in the wrong way.
Do you usually, when you see movies, disconnect the way it's done, the way the story is told, the use of the medium from its connection?
I'm sorry.
It's okay. You okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, if you go to see James Bond, do you worry about whether there could actually be such a person? I'm sorry.
I'll just take this opportunity to mention that my guest is Martin Williams, and he is the director of the Jazz and Popular Culture and Jazz and American Culture program of the Smithsonian Institution. He's the person who produced the Smithsonian collection of classic jazz albums that we frequently use as a premium. He wrote the booklet that accompanies it, written many books about jazz, and his new book, which we're discussing, is on D.W. Griffith. It's called Griffith, First Artist to Film, and it's published by the Oxford University Press.
And we will discuss it further when I can stop coughing. Excuse me, please. Yeah, go ahead. We'll give this a try.
Okay. Well, listen, I know there's a lot of people who get really angry about, say, Birth of a Nation, about being able to disconnect falsehoods and racism from the poetry of the film or the language of the film, think that that's terrible, that you shouldn't be able to disconnect that.
Well, I don't think you should be able to disconnect it, but I would like to feel that someday we'll get to the point where it isn't so quite so loaded. But it won't be loaded until we all settle the problem for ourselves, both black and white, until we come to terms with that terrible problem. Then until that happens, it'll continue to be a question that's loaded for everyone and a question that raises tempers. So I can't say anything more than that. It is a powerfully made film. There's no question about that. But after all, you know, we go to see those Nazi films like The Triumph of the Will and those things, and we admire that for technique, and we don't get that upset about it. Maybe we should,
no,
but,
a lot of
but
people
we don't.
Do, though.
But on the other hand, we didn't make those pictures. The Germans
right.
made them.
Frequently when her films are shown, they're picketed.
Yeah,
that's
okay,
how,
fine.
Yeah. Griffith was like the first film director to do what we might call epic movies with lots of extras, enormous sets.
First American, yeah.
First American.
Yeah, there were Italian spectacle films before him, and in fact, he was trying to best those things with Birth of a Nation. That was one of the reasons he went into a film like that. And he did.
What kind of system did he organize for getting extras and for dealing with them and for yeah. having enough landscape to build his sets and shoot the movie?
Well, it's amazing to think that those battle scenes in Birth of a Nation, which are so enormous, they have barely been equaled, and they are models for all the battle scenes in all films since, every one, including Coppola and anybody else. Those battle scenes were made, in a tract of land outside of Los Angeles, which looked incredibly like the South, and they look incredibly like Matthew Brady's photographs of the Civil War, which Griffith, of course, studied for the film. Incidentally, by the race, and one more little thing to say, it is based on a novel called The Klansman, which was written by a man named Franklin W. Dixon, who, believe it or not, was a Protestant minister. And compared to Franklin W. Dixon's novel, Griffith's film is mild. I mean, that novel is the vilest example of racism probably ever produced in this country by anybody, including, you know, the worst kind of scurrilous races. Dixon outdid them. Okay. Sometimes people used to say that to get all those extras, all those enormous crowds, and Griffith would go down to Skid Row in Los Angeles and get any out of work bum from among the alcoholics and among the guys looking for day work in the gangs. You know, I don't really know where he got all those people. What interests me is the fact that he had, you know, four or five assistant directors who were so incredibly devoted to the project that they were able to, you know, execute all of Griffith's command as if Griffith and all the assistant directors were one person, and everything came off almost without a hitch. For the second spectacle film, Intolerance, which, by the way, is still, even now, the biggest spectacle motion picture ever made. It's never been topped or equaled. For that film, he built a set, which the main set, which is the city of ancient Babylon, is a mile deep. Now, no one really knows what the city of ancient Babylon looked like, what the people dressed like, how they behaved, except in vague kind of general terms. So, in effect, Griffith not only invented a whole city and built it, but ancient city, but invented a whole culture and built that. And, it's really interesting to watch a modern audience, particularly a young one, who thinks that, you know, all silent films are crude and terribly amusing and campy, to show them this film, because very shortly they are staggered. They are staggered. I wish that someone, you know, well, here's another aspect of this we really should lay out on the table. There's no such thing as a silent film. There never were. A film like this with a major premiere in a large house would have a full orchestra, plus probably a couple of men behind the screen doing sound effects during the showing. It is only when it got to the third-run neighborhood house that the film would have the piano accompaniment, you know, where when the price had come way down and it had been running for a long time. So that's one of the myths that everybody cherishes, that, you know, you've got this rickety piano playing there. Another thing about silent film, which is misleading when one sees them improperly shown today, is this kind of jerkiness that everyone sees in them. Motions are so awkward and corny and jerky. That's because they're being shown at the wrong speed. They're usually being projected at the speed of contemporary sound films, which is faster than silent films. And that can ruin a work of art in nothing flat. Also, there's this. There's no such thing as a black and white film in the silent era. There was never any black and white. They were all in color. Now, not full color, but the film stock itself, the blank film on which the images were printed, was tinted. And it was tinted according to either the location of the scene or the mood or both. Outdoor shots were printed on amber. Indoor shots were printed on a deeper amber, let's say, or the outdoor would be a yellow predominant amber and the other would be an orange predominant amber. Fire scenes were in red. Night scenes were in blue and so forth. Always. Then you can also do tricks by printing. Instead of printing in black and white on top of, let's say, a yellow amber stock, you can print in blue on top of an amber stock and get an effect. There is one scene in Birth of a Nation where there's an attempted rape, for instance, and you see it takes place in a living room, and the woman in question, who is Mae Marsh, goes and smashes a window and screams out to the street. And the minute she gets the window smashed and starts screaming, then you cut to shots from the street looking in at her from the street at the window. And then you go back in the room and so forth, cross-cutting from the outside to the inside once that window's broken. Well, that's a very effective scene, even in a black and white print. But when you see it in the original color, you've got two colors being thrust at you rapidly, and the dramatic effect of that indoor somber color suddenly washed out, and this glaring yellow of the sunlight hitting the same woman from another angle, and back and forth and back and forth. Well, just the effect of shifting those colors like that is, it's remarkable. I can barely describe it because I'm not quite sure why it works, but it does. And it becomes a very different film. I recently saw Intolerance, I confess, for the first time with the proper color restored to it. And that's a different experience.
Where'd you get the print?
Oh, there's several. There are a couple of them now. The Museum of Modern Art print has it color restored, and there's one from Paul Killiam, which has it put back in, too. I saw Killiam's in Washington about 6 months ago.
While you're talking about the experience of seeing early films, mm-hmm. there's the titles also that are used to give a written message to the viewer that mm-hmm. Griffith frequently used, and you describe how the titles got written and who wrote them for Intolerance.
For Intolerance, yeah. Griffith wanted Intolerance to be a 6, 7, or 8 hour movie. It depends on what stage of his working on it you're talking about, with no titles. Maybe we should lay out the premise here. Intolerance is a 4-part movie. It is 4 episodes in history, each supposedly illustrating an aspect of intolerance. One is a modern episode that has to do with the exploitation of some factory workers by a bunch of do-gooding ladies who have nothing better to do, and a strike and the subsequent hardship caused by that and by the fact that the factory shuts down. You have this Babylonian story that we've been referring to in which it's the fall of Babylon. That's the basic story, and the battle and the sacking of the city that surrounds that. Then you have the story of the massacre of the Huguenots in France, the St. Bartholomew's Massacre, and a love story connected with that. And, by the way, another enormous set for the French court in that, and some battle scenes, of course, and, you know, running through the streets of Paris and all that. Very effective. And then you have a very stylized version of the story of Jesus. Now, what happens is he sets up each one of these stories alternately, the beginnings of him, and he will set up one story, then shift to the next and set that up, and then shift to the next and set that up. And then he will go from one story to the next much more rapidly. You see a little bit of this one, a little bit of this, and a shorter bit of this one. And in the end of this film, you've got the climax to all 4 of these stories, which involve a lot of action, all except, of course, the Christian story, it's very slow. It's just to walk to Calvary and the crucifixion. So that's a kind of, you know, foil to the violence and action of the rest of them. But all these stories cross-cut, coming to climax at once. And it's been compared to Fugue, which indeed it should be, you know. And it is the most incredibly exciting experience. I mean, this is something no one should miss if he possibly can avoid it. And by the way, that Intolerance is an example of a film that was not very successful in its own time, but it's been shown ever since. And I have a feeling, by the way, that if somebody put that in the Radio City Music Hall today with a full orchestra and a color-restored print on that huge screen, it could play almost as well as Napoleon did recently. About that success. I would love to see that tried because it has never been properly shown since it opened in, when is it? You tell me you read the book, the mid-teens, right after the Second World War.
When I saw Intolerance,
First World War.
I've seen it at a university screening, and mm-hmm. it was completely silent. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it was the restored colored film because I don't remember seeing any color.
Yeah. Oh, and photography in silent films was superb, crisp. It's clearer and crisper, by the way, than many contemporary films.
Well, you know, getting back to the titles that you started talking about, there were
You started, and I didn't finish. So, yeah.
The titles, as you explained, were written by Anita Loos, who recently died, and who convinced him to use it. And I know for a lot of viewers that the titles seem really corny and end up being sometimes an obstruction to enjoying the film.
Well, that's too bad. But it's in a way, maybe it's like the kid who says, I don't want to read Shakespeare. He wrote that old-fashioned English. I can't even understand it. Sounds silly to me. Or the other one who says, you know, Hamlet's no good. It's just a bunch of quotations strung together. Sure, you have to overcome that. It's, you know, if you read a 19th century British novel, you have to, there's a kind of formality of language there that some people find difficult and doesn't read like Ernest Hemingway. Well, one of these days you may reread Ernest Hemingway and find that's terribly corny and childish. Who knows?
Were the theaters changed to accommodate these grand movies that were being made?
Yeah, they really, well, Birth of a Nation is what did that. The large movie emporia, as they call it, which are mostly gone now, of course, were built on the basis of the success of that picture. And they said, you know, in other words, he brought in large audiences for a sustained run of a film into enormous auditoriums. And that, of course, that wasn't shown in movie auditoriums because there weren't any big enough. So it had to be shown in the big opera house or whatever, in the biggest auditorium in town. But from that point on, they started building movie houses, big ones all over, everywhere. And we've only recently seen the demise of that kind of thing.
Is there anything left from the sets that he built?
I don't think so. I mean, some souvenirs. The Intolerance set, that incredible set, was abandoned, and it just sat in the middle of Los Angeles for years and decayed and fell apart, and, you know, and finally it had to be removed as they thought the wall was going to fall over on the traffic, finally, and it had to be torn down because it was a public hazard.
Can you imagine blindfolding an archaeologist and leading them to the set from Babylon?
He wouldn't recognize it, I'm sure, because nobody knows what Babylon looked like.
Well, you mentioned that silent movies were never silent, that there was always music being played.
And usually especially written for the film or put together from indigenous sources for the film, yeah.
Well, why don't we listen to some of the music that was written for Intolerance? And we're going to hear it performed by Gaylord Carter on a Movie Palace, Oregon. This is from an album called The Mighty Wurlitzer, which was compiled by New World Records. And we'll listen to this, and then I'll continue speaking with my guest, Martin Williams.
Thank you.
theme from Intolerance that was used during portions of the Babylon sequence, and that was played by Gaylord Carter from an album of the Mighty Wurlitzer Movie Palace Organs, music from Movie Palace Organs on New World Records. My guest is Martin Williams, and he's the director of the Jazz and American Culture Program at the Smithsonian Institution. He's written numerous books, many of them about jazz. His newest book is called Griffith, that's D.W. Griffith, First Artist of the Movies. You said that on a new print that this is of Intolerance, that the music is on the film.
Yeah,
now.
It is made into a sound print. The one that I have seen lately, the color is restored. There is a soundtrack added with music and sound effects on organ, though, not full orchestra. And as I say, when this picture opened in the big houses for the very first runs, it would have been an orchestra playing that, not just the organ. And also... it is what it is. The film is stretched, by the way, effectively, so that it's hard to show it at the wrong speed. The process by which they do that is something I do not understand. But in other words, it can be projected at sound speed, this particular print, or these prints, and it won't look wrong.
I don't think I've ever seen a silent movie not looking wrong. But I'd like to...
Well, you know,
now
there are exceptions. The comedies, it was one of the things that made Max Senator a success was that he used to do what they call the slow crank. He deliberately had the camera run slow so that it would look speeded up deliberately, but that was for comic effect, you know.
Right. Yeah. The actress that Griffith worked most closely with was Lillian Gish, and I think she epitomized in his movies his image of womanhood.
Mm-hmm.
You say that he was really caught up in Victorian imagery, and mm-hmm. that when the times changed and we entered the, quote, jazz age, that it just didn't work. His imagery didn't catch on anymore.
Yeah. One of the things that one of the miracles that Griffith performed in film was to combine the sensibilities of the stage with those of Charles Dickens and Edgar Allan Poe, you see. I mean, he made movies not out of just the dramatic traditions of the stage, but also out of what he learned about drama from reading people like Dickens and Dickens himself and Poe, and those were his major literary influences. He didn't make a literary form, but that way of looking at the world, and particularly that of Dickens, was his way. And Dickens did look at human existence through the eyes of a kind of innocent, girl-like woman that she was his Beatrice, if you will. And in Jungian psychological terms, she was the anima of his unconscious who led him through the underworld of poetic images. And every male writer has got such a female figure. Whether she takes a back seat or not in the presentation, she's always there. I've always thought the strongest influence in Hemingway's novels is always a woman, but there is no room in his world for real women. You know? Well, that's another subject which I perhaps shouldn't get off on. But... The way of seeing the female, which arose in the 20s, in the late 20s, actually, in the so-called jazz age, which was a very short-lived phenomenon, by the way, but the ultimate fruit of the suffragette movement, I think, simply had lost its effect. I think it had lost its effectiveness for Griffith, too. It didn't. The world did not respond anymore to that point of view. And audiences didn't respond. That's clear enough. So Griffith's demise is partly due to the fact that his way of looking at existence simply wasn't contemporary at that time anymore, which doesn't mean he's dated to us necessarily. But that momentary dating in a last-minute, up-to-date idiom like the motion picture can be death. It can be ruinous.
Sure, well, the 20s would look dated now also, so it ceases to make a difference.
Exactly.
Can we thank Griffith for inventing the Hollywood death, where the dying woman is even more glamorous as she's dying or after she's dead? Because you mentioned in the movie Way Down East, I think it was, that well, why don't you tell the story? It well, really amazed me because I guess he did really create that trend.
I don't know that I can remember the days of this, but I mean the length that he took this thing, but or the details of it. But anyway, the point is that Lillian Gish, this frail little lady, is rescued from a considerable stay on a block of ice in which she's nearly dropped over a waterfall in the frozen winter, you know, lying there unconscious. And in fact, she almost was when they shot the scene. And then she is rescued at the last minute, of course. And then here she is standing in the hero's arms, and Griffith said, "Go comb your hair and fix your face." And she said, "But I just got out of this, you know, you just pulled me off this waterfall." And he said, "That doesn't matter. The audience doesn't want to see you look like that. They want to see you look nice now. You've been saved, you know." But, you know, theater is a medium of illusion, and the conventions of one period may seem strange in another period. I remember when I was young, most of my contemporaries thought it was very strange that Hamlet would come out and talk to the audience about what was going on inside his head. But it doesn't seem so strange anymore because we have other ways of doing that now. And we've gotten used to it all over again, you know. So maybe the idea that she's prettified in the end is not so appalling as one might like to think. I don't know. If it offends you, okay. If it offends any individual member of the audience or they think it's silly, fine. I don't think it's terribly good. I think there are ways of making Lillian Gish look attractive in almost any circumstances, and he might have used one of those rather than, you know, comb her hair and wash her face, but whatever.
That has become a tradition, though. How do you think he fared with sound films? Have you seen any of his sound films that you thought were successful? Successful in terms of what he's capable of doing?
Yeah, well, in passing, we might mention that Griffith produced a film with sound on disc long before that process became a success. And indeed, that film of Griffith's was not a success with sound, and he just withdrew the sound portion. The world was not ready for it. There were ways. This is another thing about movie history most people don't know. There were silent films with sound, so to speak, from the very beginning. In fact, Edison invented the phonograph in order to make his movies talk, or maybe it was the other way around. But the peep show with the crank in the front of the machine where you look through the viewer, actually there were ones that were cued to a cylinder record and had headphones on them, and so you heard and saw someone sing a song or whatever from the very beginnings of the movies. That got dropped. But in the mid-20s, Griffith did have a film with recorded sound and sound effects and played it that way in the opening in New York and then dropped it. But he made two full sound films. One was a biographical film about Lincoln, and the other was a film about alcoholism called The Struggle. The Struggle, it seems to me, by any standard, is a very bad movie, any standard. Abraham Lincoln is not by any means a good movie, but there are very powerful things in it, including a very imaginative use of the soundtrack, which if you want me to describe, it can take a minute. Griffith realized that you could parallel the image on the screen with a soundtrack that was happening somewhere else and get a dramatic effect out of it. And there was, I may not get the details of this scene right. I'd have to see it again to be sure or look in the book, but this is the gist of it. You begin with Griffith and an opposing candidate running for office on the stand in front of the audience at night with the torchlights up there and the cheering crowd with their signs and everything. And they're making political speeches. And you cross-cut between Lincoln saying something and the other guy. And actually, these words came from the Lincoln-Douglas debates, but this other man in the film is not supposed to be Douglas. He's just doesn't matter who he is, really. But that's where those bits and pieces of dialogue were adopted from those things. And then you fade from that the sound, the volume goes way down on that, but it still continues in the background. You know, the marching band, the argument, the cheers of the crowd, the speech, the two speakers going on and on in the background. But then the camera is in a slow pan across a hotel room, and the whole pace is different. It is very slow, and it's moving around this hotel room, and there is an immediate feeling of loneliness almost on the edge of despair in this room, while all this ruckus is going on still on the soundtrack and outside the window of the room. And the camera just pans around this room, and it is, you know, someone's temporary dwelling. Someone is there only for a time. It looks not too comfortable. It looks not lived in. Suitcases, clothes dropped. And you pass a stovepipe hat, as they call it, you know, that the Lincoln hat. And you realize it's his room. And then you pan over, and there is Mrs. Lincoln sitting in a chair waiting patiently for this outdoor carrying on to end. And then the door opens, and the noise outside dies down, and he walks in the room, and she just looks up and says something, "You must be tired, Mr. President. I'll get you something to eat." And that's it. Or Mr. Lincoln, rather. And that's it. Well, now that's one of the really most effective moments in early sound films to me. You know, literal rejuggling of time and space that's involved there with using the soundtrack for one thing while you use the visuals for another. I know later films that tried to do that kind of thing, including one of Hitchcock's, by the way, where it works less well than it does there. But otherwise, I can't really recommend Abraham Lincoln. There's some shots in it that are quite beautiful, the early parts of it, the countryside in Illinois and all that. But it is not a good movie, no. The sets are stilted. The sets look like they were built just before they started shooting. Nobody lives in his clothes. They're all in costumes. Nobody knows where his favorite chair is. And, you know, it's just, it's a very, very strange movie.
When you were going back to screen films for the research you were doing for the book, how did you look at them? When you're doing a screening for yourself and you've got the projector and you could go back and do frame-by-frame sequences if you want to, how do you look and what did you discover watching it that way?
Well, you know, I don't think for many years that I've watched a film, even when a friend was showing it, when I was in control of the projector. And I don't know that I've ever wanted to take control of it. I sit and watch the film, I hope, like maybe a little more enlightened member of the audience or something. I don't stop and start often. I have watched a couple of things, of course. Even just stop frame to identify an actor and actress. You'll do that, you know. But by and large, no. I just sit there and watch it run through and hope that I can persuade who's ever running it to run it at a better speed. And, you know, get it in focus when he switches reels, which is always a problem, even when you pay it a $5 admission. And, you know, like that. I could do other things, I suppose, but I've never really wanted to. I guess what you're asking me in a way is, do you listen to a record the same way when you're going to have to review it as you do when you're just listening to it? And the answer to that is no, I don't. But if you ask me to tell you what the difference is, I don't know what the difference is.
Yeah, well, you see, but records you have in your home, and you could play them backwards or do whatever you please.
I'm watching most of these films in private screening rooms or friends' homes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Bill Everson showed me half of these movies or re-showed them to me for the purposes of this book in his own living room. God bless him, because I don't own prints of these movies.
Sure, sure.
He does.
I'm talking to Martin Williams, if you're just joining us, and we're discussing the subject of his newest book, which is called Griffith, First Artist of the Movies. You don't hear on Oscar night a lot of people going up and mentioning Griffith or on the great television self-congratulatory film industry spectaculars. There haven't been many things done about Griffith. What kind of recognition do you think he should have within the industry?
Well, what do I think he should have? I don't know within the industry because, you know, it would be very difficult for anybody to write a really aesthetic history of the movies from the point of view of Academy Awards or the so-called Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, let's say. That would be a dismal task. And that's a dismal operation, I think, altogether. The longer I live with the fact of that organization, the less trouble I have getting used to it, but maybe, you know, my respect or lack of it doesn't change much. Because its primary function has always been for the movie industry to get together with itself every year and congratulate itself and make love to itself. And thank all the little people out there for their help. And I don't expect much. I know that when the American Film Institute, is there to take a different approach, and there one expects more. When the Hollywood Museum, which turned out to be a fiasco, not, I think, it shouldn't have surprised anybody, but when they were founding that and when they were meeting to see what they were going to do about that, there were twice as many people in public relations as in anything else, which means that there are twice as many people who are going to explain to the press and the public what they're doing as there are anybody doing it, whatever it was. They hadn't even decided what it was, you know, what they were going to do. Look, you know, they're in show business. They're worried about next week's gross receipts. And if they're performers and more creative people, they're worried about next year's or next month's project. I don't know any reason why they can't honor their forebears, but they don't think that way. Americans don't think that way. I mean, I'm sitting here telling you all kinds of things about our culture that most of us don't know anything about. So why should we expect people in the movie business to be any different from the rest of us? Because they are geared to please a mass audience, and I don't put that down per se at all, as you know. But it is not the kind of the people who do that day after day don't exactly have the kind of heads who are going to put up statues in the park. Somebody ought to be putting those statues up, however.
What do you think is happening in the film industry now that you consider to be really innovative?
I'm not sure that there's anything. Huh. And I know that disappoints perhaps you and certainly a lot of other people. I'm not sure. This is real heresy. To me, and I don't mean I haven't seen good movies lately. I think that Raiders of the Lost Ark is absolutely the greatest piece of adventure hokum trash that I have ever witnessed in my life. That is so skillfully done that it's just surpassing. You couldn't do that any better. And to me, it's much better than all the other successes of the summer that I've seen. I've seen Superman 2. I've seen the James Bond thing, which has some incredible stunts in it and all that. But that Raiders is a masterpiece of knowing what the heck you're up to and knowing how to do it. Now, not to judge what it is, but, you know, just getting it off. But I think, you know, to me right now, and this really is heresy, as I say, the most interesting things happening in American drama are happening on television. I know I just lost 70% of your audience right there when I said that, but it seems to me that there is more genuine experimentation on commercial television than anywhere else.
What are some examples of that?
Well, the obvious example that anyone would invoke would be Mary Tyler Moore. Now, of course, that's off right now. I mean, it has run its course. But to me, that was a level of sophisticated comedy about human relationships, the like of which we have never created before. And it could not have happened anywhere but on television. The obvious secondary case for it is still running and still a matter of excellence, and that's MASH. Now, it seems to me that a medium which has produced those two shows within the same decade doesn't need to apologize for all of its trash. There is a lot less trash on television, proportionately, probably, than there is anywhere else. I mean, after all, if you had to read all the novels written in this country in a year, you would throw up your hands and say the state of literature is just, hopeless, wouldn't you? And yet somehow, if it's television and there's that much trash produced, we think that we have to sneer. Well, we don't sneer at the novel as a form just because a lot of trash is written in the idiom. And it is, again, a popular form, you know, basically. So why is it that, you know, if a lot of television is no good, we have to talk like it is a contemptible medium per se? I don't understand that. I also am impressed, as most people are, I think, who take television at all seriously, with Hill Street Blues. I think that is a show of great promise. It has an interesting heritage to me because one of the shows of the 60s, early 60s on television, and a landmark as far as I'm concerned, was Naked City. I mean, the best 10 shows from that series are stunning drama. And a kind of drama which you couldn't find anywhere else, and a view of big city America which you couldn't find anywhere else. Now, that Naked City was more recently reborn in two different shows, Beretta and Kojak. And what you have there is the same kind of general view of a crumbling city and a handful of people without much authority who are trying with great integrity to hold it together somehow. And they can't win the war, but they win a lot of little battles. Now, but in each of those shows, you had a very different, bizarre kind of central character planted in that city. So that was the variation on Naked City. I happen to think that Beretta is a marvelous creation. I think as a dramatic comment on you know, our cities in our time, Beretta is just stunning and a wonderful creation. Now, what you've got in Hill Street Blues is a whole precinct full of nutty characters like that, you know, who instead of being comic characters like on Barney Miller and played for a kind of a low comic interplay of various levels and kinds, which they do very well on Barney Miller, not like Mary Tyler Moore, but very well. But instead of having, you know, playing it for comedy, it's if you will, it's a serious Barney Miller.
Since we're nearing the end of the show, I'll...
Better get off television fast.
Yeah, well, I'm going to look forward to your book coming out in January, in which we'll be able to read all about your views on television, and that's going to be called TV, the Casual Art, and that right. will also be published by the Oxford University Press. It's really been a treat talking with you, and I wish we had a lot more time, but unfortunately we don't. I want to thank you very much for coming back and visiting with us on Fresh Air.
My pleasure to be here.
I've been talking with Martin Williams. His new book is called Griffith, First Artist of the Movies. It's published also by the Oxford University Press. He's the director of jazz and American culture programs at the Smithsonian Institution, which, by the way, has just issued a couple of new albums, one of early recordings of Sidney Bechet, including some work with Armstrong, and they've recorded a piece never before recorded by Duke Ellington called Symphony in Black. There's also the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz, which is a 6-volume history of jazz put together by Martin Williams with a book that accompanies it. Well, that's it for this afternoon show. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll be hearing from Gus Hall, who's run for president many times on the Communist Party ticket in America. Then we'll be hearing from Philip Foner, labor historian, who's going to talk with us about what connection there is or isn't between American communism, Soviet communism, and Euro-communism. So that's all coming up tomorrow afternoon, and I hope you can join us then. Contributing to this afternoon's Fresh Air was John Zwett, and the technical director today was Stephen Waterman. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Danny Miller. The production assistant is Maeve McGoran. If you have any questions or comments about the show, why not send us a card, and I'll give you our address. It's WUHY, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, 19106. Again, that's WUHY, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Well, all things considered is coming up in just a couple of seconds. My name's Terry Gross. I want to wish you a very good evening, and thank you for listening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, where listeners supported public radio.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Sanford Unger.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
I don't think that anything's a failure until you're dead, and you're never dead until your eyes don't open. And our eyes are wide open. Our people's eyes are wide open, and we are still alive and very, very well.
Robert Poli, the embattled head of the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization. Tonight on All Things Considered, he says the strike is still on, and the controllers can hold out well into next year. And Poli insists he's not sorry he supported Ronald Reagan for president.
Also, these stories, a problem with Voyager 2 at an important moment. Its camera was pointing into space instead of at Saturn.
After Voyager's encounter with Saturn, scientists expect a 5-year hiatus in planetary exploration.
A crisis brewing in southern Africa. South African troops are deep inside Angola. American criticism is muted by continuing concern about the Cubans based in Angola.
From London, a report that slavery still exists on a large scale in the African country of Mauritania.
A food store chain here makes news by raising prices.
In Jerusalem, a crisis.